Well, welcome to Lecture 7. Could you take one of these? Well, I'm late because I printed out the wrong thing. You take one past me on. And there's two more. This is more or less some of this repeats what we did last time. Okay, so last time we looked at we began to look at the Shaiva traditions and the Tantric traditions, and we looked at the Shaiva Siddhanta and the Shaiva systems of yoga. And we looked at we distinguished between the Ati Marga, the higher path, and the Mantra Marga, the path of mantras, and how the Ati Marga consider themselves to be transcending the four ashrama system of the Vedas, to have this fifth ashrama, the state beyond the fourth ashrama. And then we began to look at the non-Siddhantika systems, but we didn't really get very far with that. So today I want to look at the non-Siddhantika systems and look at the Pratyabhijna particularly. Now, these non-Siddhantika systems that developed in the early medieval period were based on these texts called the Bhairava Tantras. Do you remember? There was the Ati Marga and the Mantra Marga. This is the indigenous classification. And then in here you've got the Shaiva Siddhanta, which we've looked at. And then we've got what we call the non-Siddhantika groups. Now the Shaiva Siddhanta have their own tantras, particularly texts like the Mrigendra, the Lord of the Animals. The Kirana is good because that's translated by Dominic Goodall. There's a good edition of the Kirana Tantra. Mrigendra, various others, which are generally edited in that series from Pondicherry. So the dualist Shaiva Siddhanta texts. Now the traditions of the non-Siddhantika accepted these texts as revelation, but had further revelations of their own. And these are generally called the Bhairava Tantras. There are various complex systems of classification that I don't really want to go into amongst the non-Siddhantika groups, but generally you could say that the Bhairava Tantras are the root texts of these traditions. Of the non-Siddhantika traditions, of particular importance is a tradition called the Trika, the threefold tradition, and that's based on a text called the Garlanded Goddess, the Malini Vijayotala, the Supreme Garlanded Goddess Tantra. There's a published edition of that in the Kashmir series of texts and studies. There's a good study with translation of some parts of it by Somdev Vasudev that came out about 2 years ago. So that this is like the Bible of the Trika religion. Now the Trika and the Malini is one of the Bhairava Tantras. Okay? Is that clear so far? You've got the two groups, you've got in the Shaiva tradition of the Mantra Marga, you've got the two traditions, the Shaiva Siddhanta, and a whole load of other groups that we can classify as non-Siddhantika groups. Amongst these, perhaps one of the most important is the Trika, the threefold tradition. Now the Trika has in its root text this Malini Vijayotra. It's like the Hebrew Bible of the Trika religion. And it's one of this wider group of tantras called the Bhairava Tantras. There are other texts that this group adheres to. Now, who about the chikka? The chikka were cremation ground ascetics. Do you remember the Karpalikas that I spoke about last time? It's coming out of a Karpalika tradition. There are several layers to this tradition. It probably originated in South India, but it certainly developed in Kashmir. And when it developed in Kashmir, it had Brahmanical commentators on the tradition. Brahmins adopted this religion and sold it, if you like, to the royalty, to the king, particularly Jayavarman. And amongst the commentators of this tradition, the most important, perhaps, is Abhinavagupta, one undoubtedly, who you've probably heard of, but he's probably famous for his aesthetics, particularly. But he is the key exponent of the Chikka religion. So Abhinavagupta, he accepts all of these Shaiva Siddhanta texts, but he regards this text, the Valmiki Vijayotara Tantra, as the supreme revelation, as the revelation which surpasses all the other tantras, and the revelation which certainly goes far beyond the Veda. Now, what is this text about? The text contains, it's mainly about mantras, ritual, and cosmology. So how do you define a tantric tradition? It's not defined by its metaphysics, by whether it's monistic or dualistic, and it's not defined by its rituals, because the ritual cuts across all these different traditions. But it's defined by the mantra system that it uses. So the Malini Vijayotra Tantra uses a particular kind of mantra system. And Abhinavagupta takes this text, writes a commentary on the first part of it, and repackages the Chikka religion for the Kashmiri Brahmin householder, and writes commentaries on other texts as well. So this becomes a very influential, important religion in Kashmir, linked to the sovereignty, and adapted and adopted by the kings, which was the main function of lots of these traditions, was to get royal patronage. And they were very successful. So the Shaiva Siddhanta more or less died out in Kashmir to be replaced by the non-Siddhantika traditions. Now, some Brahmin thinkers in the courts of the king were very suspicious of this whole tantric tradition, because they thought that it undermined Vedic values. And there are various... There was one playwright who wrote, his name will come to me by the end of the class, who wrote a play lampooning or describing the problem of these new texts being produced, and raising the question about how come we've got all these new revelations coming up, and where are they coming from, and are they valid or not, and raising these kinds of questions, which happened the same in Shaivism, in Vaishnavism, with Yamana in questioning the Pancharatra Agamas. So you've got these two traditions of the Lakshmarga, you've got the Chikka, the threefold tradition. It's called threefold because it's based on three goddesses called Para, the supreme goddess, Apara, the non-supreme goddess, and Para-Para, the supreme non-supreme goddess. And these three goddesses are envisaged as residing on the prongs of a trident. Para in the middle, Apara to one side, and Para-Para to the other side. So that's the central image, or the central icon of this religion that Abhinavagupta adopts and is at the heart of his system. So you've got these Karpalika groups, they're cremation ground ascetics, and there are lots of precedents for this, from Buddhism, Buddhist monks living in cremation grounds, and meditation on death and so on. And there's an interesting passage in the Pali Canon where a woman called Kali makes an offering of of food to a cremation ground ascetic, to a monk living in the cremation ground. So that was very early. That's very interesting that her name should be that as well. I don't have the reference here, but I can get it for you. So there is this strong tradition of a cremation ground asceticism, and yoga developing amongst these fringe ascetic groups. Propitiation of gods through offerings of impure substances, blood, meat, alcohol, and caste-free sex. That was the main ingredients of the ritual worship for these ferocious goddesses who have to be appeased in the cremation grounds by these Kapalikas and the low castes who supported them. Now, Abhinavagupta wants to strip the religion from those cultic associations. And so he says the true Shaiva doesn't have any marks, doesn't have any lingers, doesn't have any... you can't tell a Shaiva by their external appearance, by being covered in ashes or anything like that, because a true Shaiva is a practice that you do in your heart. So there's an internalization of these external cremation ground practices with Abhinavagupta in his version of the trigger. And this tradition, of course, carries on right the way through to today, to the Agoris of Benares. Another group among the non-site Hartika traditions is called the Krama, which had its own scriptures and was also very influential in Abhinavagupta, and a third sect called the Kula. The Krama means gradation or system, and Kula means family. Now the Krama system worships Kali, the ferocious goddess Kali. Kali is at the heart of the Krama system in various forms. One of Kala Samkarshi, the attractress of time, or the destroyer of time. So she is the goddess Kali is at the centre of this system. And from last week, I don't know if you brought it along, but there was a hymn that I gave you. Have you got this from last week, any of you? Yeah. This is a Krama. I mean, you've got one of these. This is a Krama hymn, the Dehastha Chakra Devatar structure, the hymn to the circle of devatars, of deities, located star in the body, in the Deha. So this is. This is the Krama pantheon, if you like. This was attributed to Abhinavagupta, but it wasn't written by him. It's a Krama text set in the context of the Krama liturgy, the Krama ritual. So you'd visualize these in the morning, you'd visualize these deities. So, Om homage to Ganesh, Om holy, I praise Ganapati, Ganesh, whose body is the inhaled breath. So there it's identifying the deity with the inhaled breath, who is worshipped at the beginning of 100 philosophical systems, who delights in the bestowal of desired wishes. I praise Vatuka, who is Skanda, who is he's the exhale breath, got two inhale breaths, who removes people's pain. His feet are worshipped by the lineage of perfected ones, the Siddhas, and the hordes of yoginis and the best of heroes. I always praise the pure, true master, the Satguru, whose nature is attentiveness or awareness. By the power of his thought, he reveals the universe as a path of Shiva and his devotees. And that's a very interesting idea, that the guru reveals the universe, opens out the universe as a path to follow towards the goal of liberation. I praise Ananda Bhairava, that's a form of Shiva, who is made of consciousness, Chinmaya, whom the goddesses of the senses constantly worship in the lotus of the heart, with the pleasure of their own sense fields. So here you've got all the goddesses, the five, six senses, are associated with goddesses, are personified as goddesses. And the image is that the objects of the senses, like, are personified and offered to Ananda Bhairava in the heart by the goddesses of the senses. I praise Ananda Bhairavi, whose nature is awareness, who continually performs the play of creation, manifestation and tasting of the universe. These are the three Krama categories: the creation, tasting, relishing, and manifestation of the universe. I constantly bow to, and here we have the seven goddesses, sorry, eight goddesses, Brahmani, whose nature is the higher mind, situated on the petal of the Lord of Gods, Indra, in the east, who worships Vairava with the flowers of certainty. I always praise Mother Shambhavi, whose nature is the ego, the Ahankara, seated on the petal of fire. She performs worship to Vairava with the flowers of pride, or ego. I always praise Kumari, situated on the southern petal, whose essence is the mind, who gives offerings to Vairava with the flowers of discrimination. And I constantly bow down to Vaishnavi, four-headed goddess, seated on the southwest petal, the power of whose nature is that which is heard, or perhaps scripture, who makes offerings to Vairava with the flowers of sound. I honour Varahi, sorry, that's the four-headed goddess, Varahi, who possesses the sense of touch, seated on the western petal. She satisfies Vairava with flowers of touch which captivate the heart. I praise Indrani, whose body is sight, whose body is seated in the northwest petal, who worships Vairava with the most beautiful and best of colours. I bow to Chamunda, that's the emaciated goddess, called the sense of taste, dwelling on the petal of Kubera in the north. She constantly worships Vairava with offerings of the varied six flavours. And I always bow down to Mahalakshmi, known as the sense of smell, who is seated on the petal of the Lord. She praises Vairava with varied fragrances. I praise constantly the Lord of the body, who gives perfection, known as the self, united with the 36 tattvas, categories, which you can get at last time. He is worshipped as the Lord of the six systems of philosophy. In this manner, I praise the circle of deities innate within the body, an elevated assembly continually present, the end of everything, vibrant, and the essence of experience. Thus, the sacred hymn to the circle of deities in the body is fully completed. It's a very interesting hymn, this, because you've got the circle of deities, the goddesses, who are identified with the tattvas, the 36 tattvas that we looked at last time, with the categories of the universe. So you've got a correspondence between the body and the cosmos in this text. And Ananda Bhairava, in union with Ananda Bhairavi, Shiva and Shakti, and in the heart. So the body is like a lotus, and the goddesses make offerings to Shiva in the heart. So this is the Krama system, really. Krama system of deities. And another slightly different version, you get Kali at the heart, not and Ananda Bhairava leads the picture altogether. So anyway, this is the kind of material that Abhinavagupta is absorbing and adapting to the householder's life. Right. Sorry, I've gone off a bit from my planned lecture. Never mind. Okay, you've got the picture. You've got these two systems. You've got the Trika, and you've got the Krama and the Kula. These are three different traditions within the non-Siddhantika systems, right? The Trika, Abhinavagupta, is a key philosopher who writes commentaries on the heart text of the tradition, and is strongly influenced by the Krama doctrines. And at the heart of the Krama, you get not Shiva, but the goddess Kali. And also within the Krama, Kali is understood as consciousness, as pure consciousness. So you get a mythological language which is then combined or mapped onto a more psychological language of awareness and consciousness. So Kali becomes a synonym for consciousness, and that is directly influences Abhinavagupta's Pratyabhijna, as we'll see. So Abhinavagupta wants to adapt this religion to the householder's life, as I said. And the Pratyabhijna is the philosophical expression of this. The Pratyabhijna is the philosophical articulation of this monistic religion. But before I talk about that, I just want to mention one more thing, and that's that the Trigger has two ritual systems. One is called the Tantra system, and the other is called the Kula, which is the same name as this other sect, of course. And the Prakriya. Prakriya is a difficult word to translate. It probably means ritual system, but it could mean hierarchy. And the Tantra Prakriya is the system that the Shaiva would have to do every day. You want to become a Shaiva, which guarantees your liberation, of course. So you do the Tantra Prakriya every day, which involves visualizing a trident that pervades your body and ends at the crown of your head with these three goddesses located on it. And at the heart of this trident, you can't have a heart of a trident, can you? But at the point where the three prongs come out, you've got the goddess Kali. That's Kala Sankarshi. And so by implication, the three goddesses are emanations of Kali. But she's hardly ever depicted. She's not represented because she's unrepresentable. She's called the unnameable. So she's beyond names, and she's identified with pure consciousness, of which the three goddesses are emanations. And so you visualize this in your daily practice, this trident, and you do the usual practices of purification of the body, inner worship, the divinization of the body through Nyasa that we looked at last week, and inner worship, which is visualizing this trident, and outer worship, making offerings to a portable icon of Shiva, a linga. And that's what you do every day. And then at death, you'll achieve liberation. And there's another system called the Kula Prakriya within the Trigger religion, which is a secret ritual, which is a pure sort of left-hand tantric ritual, which involves sex with a duty, with a messenger, a Shakti, in which you offer make offerings to Kali in your heart, and the practice of this ritual, which we're supposed to do about 3 or 4 times a year, I can't remember the precise number, is the quick path to liberation. So you get liberated, which otherwise would take thousands of years with floods of mantras. You can do this in a very quick way through following the Kula Prakriya, but you have to do it without desire, because if this ritual is done with desire, that leads to the realm of the Pishachas, the demons. So it's not for the faint hearted, as it were, that the Kula Prakriya, and that's the esoteric ritual coming from the Kula and the Krama traditions, but being absorbed by Abhinavagupta into his synthetic sort of version of the Trigger, into his system. And I should have said that Abhinavagupta's key text is the Tantra Loka, the illumination of the Tantras, in which he describes these ritual systems. One more thing. Shaiva Yoga, on the outline here, you've got the system of Shaiva Yoga. The Malini Vijayotra Tantra mentions different methods of achieving liberation. And there are three methods in particular that Abhinavagupta discusses, and indeed which are in that text. One's called the individual, or the Arnava means. One's called the Shatra, the energy means, and one's called the Shambhav, or the divine means. So I'm just wondering whether to go into this or not right now. How are you feeling? Are you feeling overwhelmed with information? Or not? No, okay, I'll just carry on. The So you've got these ritual systems in the Trika. You've also got three kinds of yoga, three paths of yoga. One's called the Shambhava, the divine. And this is associated with the human faculty of will. One's called the Shakta, the energy, if you like, the Shakta from Shakti, energy or power. And that's associated, oddly, with cognition or knowledge. And the other one is the Anava, the individual path, which is associated with action. And the word they use here is upaya, method, or means. Now these are in the Vamana Vijayotra Tantra, the root text of the Trika. Abhinavagupta reinterprets them. The Shambhava upaya is liberation through the upsurge of will. Now he interprets this very widely, the word Iksha. The semantic range of Iksha for Abhinavagupta includes desire. Well, in fact, for the Sanskrit it does. So, in English, will and desire are distinct, really. They're related, but I don't think they overlap to such a strong degree as they do with Iksha, which means will, intention, but also desire. And it has the implication of instinct and emotion. So, the Shambhava upaya is the upsurge of instinct and emotion as an act of will, which shatters thought construction. So usually you're thinking about, you know, what's for dinner, I've got a toothache or whatever, the usual thought patterns, which have to be shattered in order to realise the non-duality of consciousness. To become enlightened, you have to stop usual patterns of thought. And you do that through shattering thought construction to this upsurge of emotion and in instinct. In situations such as fear, desire, pain, even when you sneeze. Or Abhinavagupta says, when you see a loved one after a long time, unexpectedly, there's this upsurge of longing and happiness. And that's an example of that which shatters thought construction. But the Jnana Bhairava, another one of the Bhairava Tantras, said, if you scratch your arm with a sharp instrument that causes pain, and that can shatter thought construction. Some kind of asceticism will be given that. Okay, the other means is the Shakta is cognition. So Abhinavagupta says, okay, there's a hierarchy here, by the way, this is the highest. Then there's cognition, or Jnana is the next, which means that you have a pure thought, like I am omniscient, or I am Shiva. And that pure thought, you keep thinking about it, and that pure thought will purify the other thoughts until eventually you reach liberation. So here is the model of consciousness as a stream of moments, which is the same for the Buddhists, but the difference is here that you've got a substratum of the self. So one thought moment leads on to the next. And so if you have a pure thought here, that will gradually purify all the future thought moments until you reach the goal, which is enlightenment. Body. Now, so that's just thinking of pure, I am Shiva, I am omniscient, and the existential realization of that thought moment, of that thought. And lastly, action is all usual ritual practices, usual religious practices. So it's yoga and ritual, mantra. All mantra repetition is within that, within the Anava upaya. So Kundalini, that's in there, Kundalini yoga. Kundalini is the serpent power who is said to reside at the base of the spine or the base of this central channel that pervades the body. I don't want to go into all that, but anyway, so all these yoga and ritual and mantra are in there. Lastly, there's something superior to all of that, which is the anupaya, the non-method, the method which is no method, the non-means. And that is the sudden awakening to enlightenment without any method at all. And I think the reasoning behind this, Abhinavagupta says, how can you, if everything is consciousness only, as Abhinavagupta maintains, how can a method lead to that realization? Because any method entails a dualism between subject and object. If there is, if there's no covering over consciousness, he says, how can there be the cessation of a covering? For example. So this is the pure. This is the logic of a pure monistic system. I'm trying to find a quote here. Here's a quote from the Tantra Loka, where he explains this. So it, the Anupaya, is not the object of meditation due to the non-existence of a meditator, nor is it the meditator due to its being bereft of an object of meditation, because there's no subject and object, there's no meditator and no object of meditation. It is not the object of worship because there's no worshipper. And it is not the worshipper due to the non-existence of an object of worship. It is not mantra, and nor its object, and not the Lord, who is the possessor of mantra. The great Lord is not initiation, nor the initiator, nor the initiated. So ultimate reality, if you like, can't be seen in terms of a god, or in terms of a method, or in terms of a self distinct from an object. So what is it then, this Anupaya? It's a sudden awakening to the truth of non-dual consciousness, and it's also called grace, anugraha. But oddly, how can that be grace? Because grace implies a theistic reality, and Abhinavagupta says as well, what he interprets by grace here is a sudden awakening to non-dual consciousness. Any understanding of grace as in theistic terms, is a way of thinking, but it's a lower way of thinking. And the other word that he used is the descent of power, shakti, pata. So this shakti descends upon the upon you. And that's grace. And that's the anupaya, the pathless path, where the goal is the means, if you like. The goal and the method are identical. The sudden awakening, through no effort, effortless sudden awakening. And that, for Abhinavagupta, is the height of the system. Oh, I've got a quote here on the handout, the non-reads. The Supreme Lord is the essence of his own light. And our own self. This is from the Tantrasara. By what means then is he to be achieved? Due to his own light, he cannot be known. Due to his eternity, his essence cannot be attained. Due to the non-existence of a covering, there cannot be the cessation of a covering over consciousness. Due to the absence of a distinct penetration into the reality, there cannot be any penetration of the Lord. What then is the means? If it is distinct, it cannot be accomplished. Therefore, this totality, the single reality of consciousness only, undivided by time, unlimited by space, unclouded by constraints, and unobstructed by forms, unsignified by words, and unmanifested by means of knowledge. Oh, I've got the other quote there as well, so you can read it yourself. So that's the central idea of the Pratyabhijna. The Pratyabhijna means recognition school. So that the anupaya is the method or the non-method which leads you to realize your identity with Shiva and with who is consciousness. And that is pratyabhijna, the sudden awakening or recognition that you are that awareness. Now you've got two forms of this kind of idealism. Idealism is the doctrine that you can't give an account of the world independently of consciousness, as opposed to materialism. So idealism, this is a kind of idealism. And you've got idealism in philosophical argument in this tradition, and you've got also the idea of idealism revealed in scriptures, which is discussed not so much in terms of argument, but more in explanatory or hermeneutical terms. And you've got two ideas associated with this. One is that the world is a manifestation of consciousness, so you get a language of coagulation, as sweets are a coagulation of sugarcane juice, so the cosmos is a coagulation of pure consciousness. It does not lose its sweetness as much for Ananda. So you get this language of solidification and coagulation, and of hierarchy. The lower levels are emanations of the higher, but they're all the transformations of the same substance, which is consciousness. So there's that kind of language. On the other hand, you get a much more rigorously non-dualistic language, which says that the world is consciousness. It's not a manifestation of consciousness, but is identical with consciousness. So subjects and objects are identical. So the appearances, the abhasa of the universe, of the world, is consciousness. And you have to see it as that. So enlightenment is not some place that you go to, not a different place or a different state, but this world seen correctly and seen as consciousness. So then these abhasas are not so much emanations, but are that very consciousness. And that is a liberating cognition. One of Abhinavagupta's teachers, called Utpaladeva, wrote a text in which he describes this philosophy. And in his commentary there, he talks about how distorted perception is corrected by a later correct perception. As in the case of someone seeing silver, which on inspection turns out to be mother of pearl. So you're walking along the beach, you see some money, you pick it up and you find it's shells. And that's the sudden recognition that it's shells. Or you see two moons in the sky, and later you find that you were drunk or something, or that it was a disease of the eye, and then you see the one moon, which corrects that earlier incorrect perception. So likewise, seeing the world as Shiva corrects in earlier incorrect perceptions of a dualistic nature. So, I don't think I'll go into all of this now. One cognition then entails the absence of others, and one cognition corrects previous error. But even so, there's no way in this system, or any system, of telling whether your perception is correct or not, other than by subsequent perception to correct error. So you see the moon as one. I used to see it as two. Now I'm seeing it as one, which is a corrective perception. But there's no way of telling how you know that perception is a correct one. I mean, that could be delusion as well, as far as I can see. Then you see it again as two. Does that two moons correct the earlier perception of the one? But So the answer to that within the Abhinavagupta system is fairly pragmatic. You refer to what works in the world. So it's not anti-world. It's a pragmatic theory of truth in a sense. But it nevertheless maintains that the world is consciousness. And that's what it wants to emphasize. So it's not like the Vedanta system of Shankara that we looked at a few weeks ago. And realization of this anupaya is the immediate liberation from the cycle of rebirth. Now lastly then, there's a lack of ethical discourse in this system. Abhinavagupta is interested in ontology, is interested in epistemology, but there's very little talk about ethics. And part of the reason for that is possibly because he sees ethics purely as social conventions, which the truth of pure consciousness transcends. So, and he's always and digging, having a dig at the Brahmins, who are Vedic Brahmins, who are inhibited by their by shanka, by apprehension or fear of breaking the rules, as it were. So the Mimamsaka text begins atato brahma jignasa, dharma jignasa. Now the inquiry into dharma. Dharma is the key concept in the Vedic tradition, arguably. Now Abhinavagupta thinks that the conventional Brahmanical dharma is prohibitive and stops people from realizing the truth of pure consciousness. And you have to transcend and go beyond your inhibitions to realize the undivided, unlimited truth of pure awareness. And he's often taking the Mickey out of the Brahmins for, he's a Brahmin himself, but for their adherence to Vedic law. So it's potentially, or sort of undermining of caste distinctions and social order. And this was perceived by many other thinkers and writers at the time, particularly the dramatists, who were worried by this doctrine pervading the courtly circles, because they thought it undermined social values, which indeed I think it probably does. Abhinavagupta was aware of this as well. Whereas Abhinavagupta thought it was a good thing that his doctrine should undermine social values, others thought it was eroding the society. I can't remember the name of it, he wrote the Bouquet of Logic, and also wrote a play called The Agama Dumbra, Much Ado About Scripture, somebody translated it. Samson translated it. Agama Dumbra. Does anyone remember? Bhatta Narayana, is it? I just can't remember his name, sorry. Anyway, this is a play, possibly by Bhatta Narayana, but I can't remember his name, in which he is a comedy. It's actually quite funny. It's been translated recently in that Clay Sanskrit Library series, in which there's a bunch of Karpalikas, and he's... it's all about the nature of scripture, really, and the justification of the king. And he argues in this play that the king should get rid of these Karpalikas because they're undermining society. And there's another in his Agama Dumbra, in his, I think it's Butter. It's really annoying, isn't it? It's on the tip of my tongue. But he wrote this great thick book. He was a Nyaya philosopher, a great thick book called The Bouquet of the Flowers of Logic. And he wrote it in prison, he says. So we don't know why he was put into prison, but he was in prison, and he says in this book he wrote this great thick thing because he was bored in prison. And in that book he talks about the non-Vedic scriptures, the tantras, and how there's a great proliferation of these tantras occurring, and he can't see a problem with it. He says that why can't the Lord have new revelations? There's no problem with that. So he's a universalist, he's a kind of Hindu, really, in a kind of more modern sense. So all these scriptures are indeed revelation, he says, but there's one sect who he says that their scriptures can't possibly be revelation because they teach impure and immoral actions. And this was the sect of the blue clad, the Nilambaras. And he says they practice sex covered in a blue cloth in public. And he's terribly shocked by this. And he, in the Agama Dumbra, he convinces the king to ban this sect because they're undermining social values. I guess a bit like the Moonies or something, you know, in 10th century Kashmir. So you do have a tension then at this time between these new sects, these new traditions arising, and the sophisticated kind of aesthete like Abhinavagupta advocating these values, and other Brahmanical groups arguing that actually they're undermining the social fabric, and that they're that they're dangerous. But nevertheless, these groups became extremely influential and powerful and went into South India and became adopted by various kings. Now, the tantric traditions in South India was mainly called the Sri Vidya. And there's a strong Sri Vidya tradition in South India to this day. And they became fairly conventional, really, and adopted fairly Brahmanical, high-caste tradition. But the language of the Sri Vidya comes right out of the language of the Trigha and Abhinavagupta's tradition. But it's the Sri Vidya, whereas you've got Kali at the heart of the Krama and Abhinavagupta's system, the heart of the Sri Vidya, you've got the beautiful goddess Tripura Sundari. And the idea of the yantra, she becomes fairly abstract with the yantra, those interpenetrating triangles, that becomes the focus of your worship. But again, metaphysically non-dualist. The Shaiva religion became dominant, really, and throughout the whole of India during the medieval period, from about the 8th century right the way through to the later Middle Ages. And the Vaishnava traditions had adopted a similar pattern, really. So you had a group of texts called the Pancharatra, which we'll be looking at next time, the Pancharatra texts, the Pancharatra Agamas, which strongly influenced Sri Vaishnavism. But you never got a strong commentarial tradition on those texts the way you did in Shaivism. Shaivism operates at the highest levels of the culture of the time, the intellectual culture of the time, and engages with Buddhist philosophy, with Mimamsaka philosophy, with Vedanta philosophy. But the Pancharatrikas tended not to do that, and it's not quite clear why that was the case. There are no commentaries on the Pancharatra texts, for example. And I think it was because they decided they get absorbed into the Sri Vaishnava tradition, and you get commentaries written on the mainstream Vedanta tradition instead, on the Brahma Sutra and so on, but not on the Pancharatra texts, because their status remained ambiguous. Although Yamana defended their status, it nevertheless remained ambiguous. But anyway, that's for next week. So, by way of conclusion then, you've got what we've done today. We've looked at the non-Siddhantika traditions, and I've attempted to describe Abhinavagupta's philosophy of consciousness only in his Pratyabhijna, or the recognition school. So I'm going to stop talking. Any questions or comments or objections?
And you said that it was, you had to do it for that desire.
Yeah.
And then, on the other hand, there is no aversion to kind of regulation and everything. And
That's contradictory, I agree. Yeah. I think you've got both. I think in the early tantras, in some of those Bhairava tantras, you've got ferocious goddesses who need to be appeased, and you appease them through meat, alcohol, and offerings of sex. So sex becomes a ritual ingredient that you offer to the goddess to appease her. In the later tradition of Abhinavagupta, and in the Kula Prakriya, it becomes, it's not a ritual substance almost, but it's an experience that reflects the experience of the Shiva and Shakti. And then on top of that, you've got this other idea of you have to experience that without detachment. And I think it's a paradox. I think you're right. It's almost a contradiction in a sense. How can you perform that right without desire? but it says that without niramsaris, desire. So you have to perform the kula prakriya. Ivanavagupta says without desire. So I can't respond to that any further, I don't think. But I think it's this dual, I mean, desire leads to reincarnation, rebirth. But there's the idea in these tantras to get, it's a homeopathy, if you like, you want to get rid of desire, and you do that through desire. So as you remove a thorn with a thorn, says one of the texts, so you remove desire with desire. But I think that's a later sort of rationalisation, really.
The practice,
I mean, the people practicing this must be from all kinds of levels of society, isn't it? I mean, is it instructions for householders and not just ascetics? Well, that's right. The earlier tradition was for ascetics and Abhinavagupta adapts it for householders, that's right. So, I mean, I think there are even shorter versions of, I mean, if you're busy earning a living, you can't possibly do all of the requirements for Shaiva non-dualists, it's so onerous, all these rituals you have to do and so on. So time consuming, I mean. So there are shorter versions.
There's no link between, liberation is the same society, it's just an individual thing.
It is, very much so, yeah, it's interesting.
Not,
it's not a social, it's not a collective enlightenment. That's, as far as I can see, that's the idea of a utopian collective enlightenment is not that. Is fairly absent in the Indian traditions, I think, on the whole. You get, certainly the Bhakti traditions, you get the idea of you can't gain enlightenment without everybody else kind of thing. We all have to practice together, as it were. But certainly in this system, it's you as an individual almost, really, gaining liberation. As far as I know, does anyone else know? Any sort of collective liberation ideas come to mind from India? I can't think of.
I was just thinking about Dharma because sometimes you think liberation and then also the ultimate liberation is being somehow Dharma. You have your duties in society.
Yeah. Abhinavagupta rejects that idea as being inhibition, Shankar. Although, I mean, he was probably a well-to-do Brahmin with land and so on, and didn't have to worry about these things really. But certainly, perhaps modify that view. There's a common saying that he often repeats, that externally you follow the Vedas, you're Vedic in your external practice. In your family life you're a Shaiva, but in your heart you're a Kaula, i.e. a follower of the secret ritual and so on. So he advocates a kind of social adherence to social convention to some extent, but really a disruption of it in your inner being. I think that's what it is. Although that, I mean, he does lampoon the Brahmins for following them, for being restricted and inhibited, because ethics is mere dharma, is merely social convention, and the absolute consciousness is beyond all convention. I mentioned Zaina's book last week. Oh yeah, we've got to stop. But Our Savage God, he picks up on some of these issues of ethical problems with monistic doctrines. So they're very different from Shankara's monism in this. Okay, so next week, our last week, I'll talk about the Pancharatra, the Vaishnava tantric tradition, and perhaps we'll round up. I'll just summarise, conclude what we've done. Let's see if we can make any conclusions from this kind of material. Thank you.